Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Carol Hornett. I'm the president of the Council for Disability Awareness, and we are a nonprofit whose role is to educate employers, employees, and financial advisors and consultants about employee benefits in general, and specifically about disability and income protection whenever we can in sight of the larger picture. And the name of our show is called the Financial Health and Income Network. And I am so pleased today to have on a very special guest. Dr. Stephen Schutzer is the president of the Connecticut Joint Replacement Surgeons, and as well as the physician executive for the orthopedic service line at St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center in Hartford, Connecticut, which is where I'm located as well. And he's also the physician director of the Connecticut Joint Replacement Institute at St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center. And I actually have had the pleasure of knowing him about a year, although I knew of him for many years because he is listed in Connecticut Magazine as one of the best doctors, particularly for joint replacement. So thank you for joining us, Steve. We're so glad to have you here with us today.
Thank you so much, Carol, for having me. It's a pleasure to spend the time with you.
Terrific. Well, what we're going to be talking about today is anyone certainly can listen to this show and benefit from what you're going to learn, but our audience for the purpose of this conversation are employers. And the goal that we have for today is to help employers understand what a concept that's been around for a little while is all about, and it's called value-based healthcare. And some employers, not the topic of the show today, may also hear this same phrase said within the context of something called value-based insurance design. But we wanted to take the time today to walk you through some of the basics of what this is, ground you in it, and give you enough information that you can talk with this concept about with your employee benefits broker or consultant or with an insurance carrier. So Steve, the place I really want to start is really truly the basic, is value-based healthcare. And then as a follow-up, which I'll give you now, why did you choose to get involved in this?
Yeah, so let me start with the second part of that question, Carol. You know, you mentioned, I'm an orthopedic surgeon with a special interest in arthroplasty, total hip and total knee replacement. And I became dissatisfied, disgruntled, I even say embarrassed at the state of our healthcare system about 12 or 15 years ago. And I felt that there was a moral imperative to try to improve it. I read some books about value-based healthcare written by Professor Michael Porter on redefining healthcare, and was smitten and overcome with a passion for trying to move our system to value. Now, what is value-based healthcare? Fundamentally, it's very simple. It's a delivery model in which we as providers, those are hospitals and physicians, are paid based on our outcomes. I mean, it's not unlike any other sector of our economy, where we are rewarded for outcomes. And this would be replacing the decades-old entrenched system known as fee-for-service, where providers are paid for their volume irrespective of the outcome. Put another way, Carol, if you have a bad outcome and you got to repeat it, well, guess what? You get paid again. And this just incentivizes more and more care delivery without any respect in terms of the outcomes that are anticipated.
You know, I love that explanation because it is truly at its core. It makes so much sense. And I know I started my career on the healthcare side, focused in sports medicine, and then in the larger circle of rehabilitative medicine and industrial medicine. And I think what always took me back when I talked with, you know, people from the general population or even relatives, and they would say, well, I saw an orthopedist for my knee pain, and he or she said, there's really nothing I have to worry about. And I said, well, you know, can you tell me more about that? And, you know, you'd hear some pretty significant symptoms. You'd ask if they'd ever had physical therapy. And sometimes they had and sometimes they hadn't. And I even find in the general population in these conversations, almost a lack of knowledge that there can be a difference in quality, that there can be a difference in outcome, instead of, that they paint all orthopedic surgeons with a similar brush, all physical therapists with a similar brush. How would you tell an employer who is also a person first, who doesn't have a background in medicine, why value and outcomes are important, even though that seems like such a basic question?
Well, I mean, you actually have articulated the question and the answer. It's extremely important, and there is great variation. The problem is, Carol, that I can go on Consumer Report and learn more about a toaster oven than I can about my surgeon who's about to take my hip or knee apart. And that's just unconscionable and unacceptable. So here's, again, I'm a simple-minded guy from the Bronx, as you know, and there's something called the healthcare value equation, and it's very simple. The numerator are the outcomes that matter to a given patient for their particular problem. If it's prostate cancer, it may be impotence or bladder control. That's what the patient really cares about, over the denominator, the cost. But the true cost, not the charge, but the true cost of delivering that care. So that becomes a mathematical equation upon which providers can be rated and judged. The problem is that there is no standard out there. And if you were to, you're a very sophisticated healthcare shopper, but many don't have that. And even you have trouble, correct, Carol, finding real outcomes there.
That's absolutely correct. And because I spent a lot of my career in healthcare and then insurance and then did consulting, I've had the good fortune of getting to know people like you and others. And so, frankly, if I ever had a non-orthopedic problem, I'd probably call you and say, okay, this is the problem I have. Of all the physicians you know, who is it that you like that you would go to if you had this situation? And it's most people don't have access to that kind of a network. And it's really frustrating. I think most people, including our employer listeners, don't think about it until they're in a situation that's a little more challenging or a little scary, and they start to realize that perhaps staying even in their local community may not be the best decision for them. And that's when the first time, right, you ever think about it. Truly for the listeners, I knew you from the original rankings that Connecticut Magazine had started on physicians. And originally the list was done by other physicians, and that became, as I moved into this area, because I spent my time in healthcare in the greater New York and New Jersey area, I didn't know anybody here. So that became my way of looking and finding even a good primary care physician. And so, that's one of the challenges, right? And you can imagine employers who are listening going, okay, so I want to get my employees value. I want to get them good care, good outcomes. And I will tell those employers, because I spent a lot of time in the health and productivity space, I will also tell you that when you go to a good physician, you almost always see your employees come back to work sooner, be more productive when they return. And if they haven't left the workplace, which is the ideal situation, can't happen in all situations, the same thing happens. They tend to be more productive. They tend to be at work more often. And what we're both sort of foreshadowing is something that can go beyond physicians, which is if you do need a procedure, and that's how you spend your career, is doing a lot of procedures on people, and you either have to go to a hospital or an outpatient surgery center, or something along those lines, there is a concept of value called a center of excellence. Can you help audiences understand what that is about?
About center of excellence, yeah. And I think that is a great question. Unfortunately, Carol, the term center of excellence has been bastardized to some extent, because anybody can claim they're a center of excellence. But with time and over time, various organizations are accrediting entities as being a true center of excellence, and each has their own proprietary criteria looking at whatever metrics they can access. Unfortunately, most of this data, as you know, comes from CMS administrative claims databases, which are based on coding. And you know there are all sorts of potential vagaries and inconsistencies and flaws, But be that as it may, centers of excellence do make a difference. And as you know, in our forum coming up on December 6th and 7th, we're going to be highlighting two types of centers of excellence, one being virtual with a very fascinating company called Air Healthcare from Minneapolis, the Wainwright Company, and the other one being a physical center of excellence here, the Connecticut Joint Replacement Institute. And here's some very simple data to the employers on the phone. This is data from another source, but it's factual, and it was from a very large employer in the United States, where they referred all of their patients who were in the queue for a spine operation, already scheduled, pulled them out of the queue, referred them to a spine center of excellence, and 50% of them, Carol, never had a spine operation. Now, forget the millions of dollars of savings. Just think of the human misery of those 50% of patients that would have had surgery that they never needed. Now, that's for spine. Mm-hmm. Spine is difficult because there is a lot of gray area in making decision-making on spinal surgery. But joints, to me, are kind of cut and dry. I mean, this is the way I think. Somebody has end-stage arthritis of the hip and severe pain and can't walk. They need a joint replacement. Well, the same source of information from a very large employer showed that 20% of the patients that were scheduled for joint replacement pulled out of that queue and sent to a center of excellence, 20% of them never needed a joint replacement. And that's just striking information.
You know, I will concur, first of all. I mean, when I was in sports medicine and physical rehabilitation, we had a lot of people with spine complaints. Including elite athletes, elite and Olympic athletes that we worked with on a regular basis. And some of them, even the athletes, would often want a quick fix. We did research at the center that I was at, I worked at a couple of world-class rehabilitation institutes, including the Kessler Institute for Rehab in New Jersey. And we'd done research on the topic, which we've seen replicated in other places, and that's when people go through back surgery, in 5 years, they have the same outcome as people who went through physical therapy and returned to full activity. And so I obviously know on a patient level, and I know on a one-on-one level with people, how important that is to share. But, you know, since so many people receive their health care through employers, you don't even know how happy I am about talking about this topic because I've watched it. And I will add a little bit of information to the data you shared. A person who's become a friend of mine is Tom Emmerich, and Tom was a global leader of benefits for Walmart. He's a very dear friend and used to consult for Walmart when Tom was the leader there. And Tom really was one of the first employers who brought in a centers of excellence model. And he always tells the story about contracting with Mayo and contracting with Cleveland Clinic. And the first thing that they offered to any associate in the Walmart system that was covered by benefits who needed a organ transplant was to go to one of these two centers of excellence. Their family member could come. All expenses were paid. All copays, all deductibles were waived. And 50% of the transplant patients were turned back because they didn't need the transplant.
That was
one of the most shocking things I ever heard. Because I'm like, how is that even possible? Walmart became a real leader in this field, as did many others. You know, they quickly followed suit. And so I can't emphasize enough to employers how we think when we think centers of excellence, perhaps if we know about it, we think about big things like that, right? We think about organ transplants. But I will tell you, from having worked in the disability insurance side of the business for a while, that's really a small percentage of what's happening. Big dollar ticket item from a medical perspective, but a small number of people from a population perspective. And that's why the kinds of things you're talking about, like arthroplasty and spine surgery and things that are more common, become even more important to find these value centers, these centers of excellence, places where you know your employees and their family members, if you cover their family members, are going to not only get great results, but they're going to get long-lasting great results, meaning that we don't have to do things called revisions and go back in and do surgery or have complications because they've been in a much better place.
That's right. That's right. Well, so, you know, we've just covered very briefly three different procedures, right? Organ transplant,
right.
Total joint and spine. And we're talking about 20 to 50% of unnecessary major operations. And it,
mm-hmm.
what I thought, when I drilled down in that data, Carol, what I was really interested, so that this particular large employer on par with Walmart saved in that year $20 million. It's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But what I really liked about that experience is that two-thirds of that was on the quality side, and only one-third was cutting a discount. In fact, for the employer, because many of these patients are travel patients, they netted out zero because they got a deal from the provider for the COA for these new volume patients, but it cost them to transport the patient and family. So that netted out zero. But the real value
mm-hmm.
was going to a center of excellence and deciding, you know what, this patient doesn't need surgery or having surgery and reducing those risks of complications and readmissions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Very, very well said. And I do want to remind our listeners at this point, you know, something that we had talked about a little bit before getting on the air, which is that not only is this movement important, and we are certainly, you know, directing our comments right now to just the employee population and their family members if they are covered, but this is relevant to the whole population. And I would imagine you see a mix of both people who are still working and people who are retired in the work that you do. And, you know, just for a brief comment, because some employers, by the way, as you know, provide retiree medical care. How does this apply through the entire population?
I don't really discriminate in terms of whether they're employees or not employees or their age bracket. Half of my practice is Medicare, and actually half
mm-hmm.
of my practice are commercially insured. So the average age for a total hip replacement in my practice is about 58. They're not necessarily
wow.
Older patients. But yeah, that's the average, which means that I've got some in the 40s and some in the 80s and some even in the 90s. So I don't really discriminate between what demographic they come from. You know, patients are a little more demanding today. They want to get back on their feet quicker. And again, when you have an entity that's focused, as we are, like a laser beam on arthroplasty, you just keep getting better and better and refining your outcomes, refining your processes to drive better value for the patient.
Wonderful. So well said. Now, we're talking about all the positives that are involved in value-based healthcare, and we certainly know that there can be some obstacles and there can be some challenges. Can you talk a little bit about that and what employers can do to help overcome those problems?
Carol, that is, you know, that's something that we've been thinking about here for a very long time. We've heard interesting comments from the payer community that the providers are, quote, tone deaf, end quote. And here along, we're thinking as providers, where are the employers? We've got an incredible product, many other people do as well, and it's just not gaining traction. So we're wondering where they are. They're wondering where we are. So something tells me something is in the middle and not making this happen. And as you start to learn about the complexity of the healthcare ecosystem, it becomes clear that there are many intermediaries, some of whom are not completely aligned with value. There's nothing specifically in it for them. And overcoming that takes time. Listen, it's a $3.2 trillion a year industry, of which one-third easily is waste. But that's $1 trillion that you're talking about taking from somebody's pocket, and they don't like that. And there's sorts of pushback and political things and lobbying that impede this movement to value. As you know, last year we had our first annual Moving to Value Forum at the Del Mar Hotel. This year we're having our second. It'll be at the Marriott. But last year we focused on obstacles to moving to value. And we looked at it from the perspective of the provider, the payer, and the employer. And each of these stakeholders have challenges. I would say from my perspective, the biggest challenge I see gets down to benefit design. And if patients are not incentivized to move to centers of excellence, to change their behavior, it's just not going to occur. If it occurs, it's going so slowly that it's not measurable. So if I were to employers, I would ask them to get involved at the benefit level and really start to look at, does this benefit design really move patients to higher value, or is it more entrenchment in old models and old designs? Again, there are obstacles all along the ecosystem. For us, it's data, it's physician alignment. We've been able to make some great changes. So our physicians, Carol, all abide by protocols. We have 18 clinical protocols, which we abide by so we can measure it and look how we're doing. That's a big challenge to get orthopedic surgeons to agree to anything. But we've been able to overcome that. From the employer perspective, I can tell you that if we don't start shifting market and rewarding the providers that are spending time and resources, a lot of money, then I'm afraid, it's just going to move slowly. There was a great piece the other day by, it was from Michael Thompson, in which 60% of employers are not capitalizing on their opportunities to address the healthcare waste, despite the fact that they all recognize there is substantial waste and inefficiency.
Yeah, much like you, I grew up in the New York City area, except I'm a Staten Island girl. The story you're telling, you probably heard a little bit of that in me. But the story I've tried to tell employers in particular, because that's where I've spent the majority of my latter half of my career in working with and educating and doing design with, is I literally grew up in Staten Island on what's called the South Shore of the island, and which means if you live on that shore and you go down to the end of the island, you can see New York City across the New York City Harbor. And I can't tell you how many people I grew up with, and when I was young, right, it would be more of their grandparents and sometimes their parents would have cardiac issues or cancer or, a major health condition. And instead of just driving across the Verrazano Bridge through Brooklyn to, New Manhattan, or taking the ferry and going into one of the world-class centers of medical excellence, they would have their surgery at St. Vincent's or Staten Island Hospital, which I'm sure are fine for average things. But you don't go to a world-class – you don't give up going to a world-class cardiac center when you've got a pretty complicated cardiac condition and you can see the place where you can get the best care. But that happens all the time. People go with what they're familiar. And so you have to incent them. And so I'm so glad you brought that up. So employers, have to be incented to do it, but they also, and the employers are going to want to incent physicians to and reward physicians who are doing great care and giving great outcomes. And of course, my prejudice extends all the way to people when they're out of work. So even if I were to evaluate the services that your practice does, I would be like, not only do you get great medical outcomes, but your patients are back to work sooner and they're not going back into the OR because a mistake has been made, or they don't have sepsis, or they haven't, acquired a hospital-acquired infection. Those all become important things because it gets them, again, gets them back to work, feeling good, back to their lives, and that's really important. I'm looking at the clock, and we've got about 5 minutes. So there's two things I want to cover because I think you've talked a little bit about. I know it flies, right? There's two things I want us to talk a little bit about. One is I do want to talk about the upcoming forum, because I will tell people. I knew Dr. Schutzer on paper. I got to meet him about a year ago, will be a year in December, when I was invited to go to your first forum and was astonished. Please don't take that the wrong way, by the quality of the conference and the types of people there. So I want to talk a little bit about that. And I would like you mentioned about measuring, and I think I've covered a little bit of it, but I'd love you to close out our talk on value-based healthcare, on how would an employer know, how do they measure, other than some of the other things you've already said, in knowing that this is working for them?
Yeah, so first of all, the forum is December 6th, December 7th. We're having a Thursday evening venue at the Marriott. That's going to focus on pharma costs. Stop Overpaying for Pharmacy is the title. We've got two fabulous speakers, Pramod John and Ziad Rubai. And then the next day on Friday, we're going to focus on primary care modernization and centers of excellence. As far as measurement, you know, I always say this. I mean, orthopedic surgeons are not historically known to be a group that's really very concerned about spend. And we use expensive trinkets. Our tools are expensive. Our widgets are expensive. And we've never really paid attention to that because guess what? We don't pay for them. Someone else does. So how have we been able to take these 10 formerly competing orthopedic surgeons, right, with completely different motives, bring them together 11 years ago, align their interests without any economic incentive, and pull off what we've done here? And it comes down to data. We've got a very rich database of 30,000 patients. The data is clean, credible, and actionable, and it helps change behavior. So I would ask employers, when they're contracting, when they're discussing with provider groups, to see their data. See it. I mean, and in fact, not only see it, and it. I wouldn't even sit down with a provider without that data being available. So they shouldn't ask to see it. They should really demand it. Then the question is the data clean? And that gets very difficult because, you know, you can manipulate data any way you want. A very quick case in point, I'll point myself out, Carol. A few years ago, ProPublica came out with rankings of physicians. I looked at myself as a hip surgeon, knee surgeon. I thought it was decent anyway. Well, I got listed as a high risk provider for hip arthroplasty.
Oh my goodness!
I was upset by that, and I did a little digging. It turned out that I was taking patients back to the operating room because of bleeding in a day when we were using heparin as anticoagulant. I was taught by my mentor not to put a Band-Aid on it, take them back, and wash out that bleeding. So I was doing what I thought was best for the patient, perhaps saving infections. The very next day, another ranking agency came out and gave me the only 5-star hip replacement surgeon in the state of Connecticut. So am I a hero or am I a zero? It's like confusing to me. Wow. Same data. So it's not easy. You have to dig deep. You have to look into the information. You know, perhaps recruit some other folks like Jeff Hogan and Paul Grady, who really understand this ecosystem, to provide some insight into that information.
You know, you're so generous to share a personal story like that, because I can't imagine what your face looked like when you saw yourself being lowly rated, when that is not generally how you're known in the greater Hartford and Connecticut community. But, I'll add to that. I have a friend who is a specialty reconstruction surgeon. Not only does he only do breast reconstruction for women who've had mastectomies, but he does only what's called the deep procedure, which is where a woman, as you know, donates some of her own body tissue to form the breast mounds.
Yeah.
And what I've learned from him is there are only 12 centers around the country that do this. It's considered the state-of-the-art procedure. But the normal, what's called flap failure rate, which is really what these breast mounds are called, is 30%. In his practice, in his hospital, it's 1. But the only reason why I know that information is because I know him. And that's the challenge, right, that we still have, is how do we get that information shared in context? Well, this time has just flown, and I know that we're counting down the last minute. So I want to first of all say thank you so much for making the time to do this. I know how incredibly busy you are in all the work you do in your own professional practice, the work you do with Move to Value and the upcoming Moving to Value Forum. I will highly encourage people, because I've attended myself and will be attending again, this is well worth your time and effort, particularly if you're an employer. If you're in the greater, I would even say, you know, New York and New England area, consider coming to the Moving to Value Forum, which people can find out more information about at movingtovalue.com. It is being held in downtown Hartford, and we hope to see you there. Thank you so much, Steve. I really appreciate your time.
Carol, I can't thank you enough for this opportunity. Have a great weekend.
You too, and thank you to everyone who's listened. Take care.
Bye-bye now.